I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Larry Gifford joins me now, the Senior Program Director and Manager of Talk and Talent for Chorus Vancouver, has created a podcast, When Life Gives You Parkinson's, an informative and fascinating look at his own diagnosis, how he copes, how those around him cope, and just what medical science has more to say about the disease. We learn through the show just how many people are diagnosed with Parkinson's, as well as how little support there is for them and their families. The lack of resources for research is also something that Mr. Gifford talks about, and I'll ask him about his own prognosis, why he chose to talk about it publicly, and why he decided to use podcasting as a way to raise awareness. You can listen to and download the podcast on Apple Podcasts and all the other places you get your podcasts, as well at curiouscast.ca. A lot of us in these parts first knew about Larry from his Radio Stuff podcast. This was even before he started working at radio station CKNW here in Vancouver. His career in radio includes stints in news and sports in Seattle, Philadelphia, London, Dayton, and the city of his birth, Columbus. He's been with Chorus since May 2016, consulting with them for a time before that. It'll be good to talk to him about radio, whether it's relevant today, and the milestone that CKNW will be marking this summer, its 75th anniversary. At Gifford Tweet is the Twitter handle. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Larry Gifford. Mr. Gifford, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for doing this.
Happy to be here.
The podcast works on so many levels because it's obviously you being able to talk through what it is you're going through, and as well to inform the audience, because that's a necessary tool, because, you know, there are a lot of stuff that about Parkinson's that I learn through listening to your podcast. When was it for you that you knew that was the form to go about talking about all of this?
Well, it took me a while. I spent probably the first 8 months after my diagnosis trying to come to terms with it, usually through the end of a whiskey bottle. Once I embraced the fact that this was going to be with me for the rest of my life, and I had listened to a podcast, the Michael J. Fox Foundation podcast, and there was a doctor, Dr. Ray Dorsey, is a neurologist, and he said that Parkinson's is a pandemic. The number of people who were diagnosed with Parkinson's 10 years ago has doubled today, and it's going to double again in the next 10 years. So, and we don't know what causes it, and we don't know how to cure it. And unless people with Parkinson's start telling their stories, we'll never raise enough awareness to raise enough money to do enough research to make a difference. And I thought, I'm a storyteller. I have radio stations. I have access to TV stations, giant website. If I'm not willing to tell my story, how can I ask anybody else to? And at that moment, I decided I was going to find a way to tell my story. So I did like an audio documentary.
Right.
Wrote a blog post for globalnews.ca. I went on the TV morning shows and talked about it on World Parkinson's Awareness Day, which was last April in 2018.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, the reaction was so strong that the people were encouraging me to do a podcast. So in September of 2018, we launched the podcast.
Yeah, and you mentioned it being a pandemic, and that's something that we, I guess, never really thought about. I mean, the numbers are, as you just said, they're growing
exponentially.
Yeah, and is there an idea why that is?
There really isn't. The cause of Parkinson's is manyfold. 10% are through genetics, passed along from generation to generation. But then there's that 90%. It could be anything from your environment, like mm-hmm. if you grew up all around a lot of chemicals.
Sure.
It could be concussions. There's some debate around that. Although Muhammad Ali, they say, was not related to concussions. But we don't know why. What we do know is, for some reason, in the people with Parkinson's, there are dopamine-producing brain cells in your brain that die. They die because there's a protein called alpha-synuclein that folds incorrectly in your brain, and it, for whatever reason, cuts off the lifeline of these dopamine-producing brain cells. So by the time I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, I'd lost over 80% of my dopamine-producing brain cells, which they'll never come back.
Mm. And so I'm sure after you were diagnosed, as you go to these various doctors, you're ransacking your own head, trying to figure out, you know, how this might have began for you, how this might have started for you. And so looking at your medical history, are there any signs, say, that, that point to how you got it?
Well, I mean, I have my theories, you know, but nothing's been proven. You know, I've talked to my mom on the podcast about if there was anything weird about when I was a child. And she goes, well, you were born dead. They had to revive me. I was born chin first. I had a lot of strep throat growing up, and so I took a lot of penicillin. I was exposed to microwave ovens and aspartame and chemicals in our lawn. And, like, I was the first generation to do a lot of those things. And so you just fluoride in my water, and, like, you don't know what it is. And so you do search for, like, the cause. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter. I got it. And so now I got to deal with it.
Yeah, so are there any changes that happen, say, in your own household even, as to perhaps, I don't know, preventing it for other people who live there?
No, because, well, we've changed our diet, and we're more cognizant about exercise and stuff. But, you know, I don't know that there is anything that somebody who doesn't have Parkinson's today can do to not get it.
Yeah.
But exercise is the only thing they can prescribe for anybody to keep the symptoms at bay.
Yeah. And I was going to ask about Parkinson's, whether it's something that can be mitigated if diagnosed early.
Well, we're hoping so. Yeah. So, you know, I say we, I mean the Parkinson's community. I'm on the Michael J. Fox Foundation Patient Council, so I deal with a lot of researchers now. And what they're hoping to do is find a biomarker. So, you know, we wish there was a blood test or an eye test or something. And so they're looking for that right now, for some way to say to somebody who doesn't have Parkinson's, hey, in 20 years, you're going to start developing symptoms because we see this X marker in your whatever. And so they start treating them at that moment to keep the symptoms from the onset.
Right.
But at this stage, that's not possible, but that's the ultimate goal.
And one wonders then, is there enough research?
No.
Funding, let's see, that's, yeah.
I mean, Michael J. Fox Foundation's been around since around 2000, they've raised $900 million for research, and they're not the only ones doing it, but there are a couple of foundations that are going to be announced for the next year that are going to probably immediately be able to raise more funds than the Michael J. Fox Foundation does on an annual basis, just because who's behind them, and I wish I could tell you who that is, but it's coming. So more and more attention and money is coming to the disease because more and more people are having to deal with it.
Yeah. And so this also, because you also talked to your wife and your son on the podcast about it, are there enough resources for, say, family members in terms of how they cope and even just to get informed about what this disease is for their family members?
Not really, especially for young onset Parkinson's disease, which is what I have. It's anybody diagnosed under the age of 50.
Mm-hmm.
Like most of the Parkinson's resources are targeted towards seniors because that's who mostly has it.
Yeah.
So the exercise classes are at 10 in the morning or 11 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon. Yeah. And they're like, I got a job.
Right.
There's not a lot of, you know, support for my wife. She's been looking for a group that she could join or people she could just talk to that understand what she's going through as a mom of a 9-year-old, as, you know, somebody who's been married for 20 years, but, you know, this is new. And so she's actually talking about starting her own support group and trying to figure out what that looks like here in British Columbia.
Yeah. It's one of those conditions, one of those diseases that I guess flies under the radar. It's not as, say, ubiquitous as a cancer or heart disease, and I guess that's why a lot of people suffer as a result, right?
Well, sure. Like, I had it for probably 8 years before I was diagnosed. It started with sort of a shuffling gait. Yeah. I had just a wonky walk. I'd clomp when I walked, especially, like, my wife and I would take woods. We lived in L.A., so we'd go up in the, you know, take a weekend hike and trying to have, like, a serene moment. And it's a clomp, clomp, clomp. She's like, can you pick up your feet? And I thought I was overweight. I thought I was out of shape. I was never been 38 years old before, so maybe this is just what getting old is, you know. And so it wasn't until I was 45 that they actually diagnosed me. And along those 8 years, it was my walk, and then I lost my sense of smell, and my my right arm stopped moving when I walked, and all there's probably 7 or 8 different things that happened till ultimately my hand started to tremor, and that's when my son looked at me and goes, "Dad, what's going on with your hand?" I don't know, and so I went to the doctor.
Yeah, and so I guess, is that something that you if one does see a symptom, perhaps, or see something off in terms of how they walk or how they react to certain things, is that something that you suggest that they go get checked out right away?
For sure. It's interesting. When you talk to people with Parkinson's, they can spot somebody with Parkinson's a mile away.
Really?
Just the way they're walking or the way they're holding themselves or the way they, you know, a lot of people are depressed. That's the depression's the first symptom they get. But you can just sort of see it. Like, yeah, I can spot it. I really can. Like, and a lot of people haven't been diagnosed yet. And so what you do is you go up and you go, I see you're having trouble with your walk. I'd recommend you go see a neurologist. Mm.
Yeah. And so in one episode, I guess the first episode of the podcast, you talked about just how, I've alluded to this already, the battery of tests and the doctors that you had to go see. At one point, they thought it was multiple sclerosis.
Correct.
And I guess that's one of the misconceptions that people have, is that those two, Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis, are related. Are they?
They're not related, but they're very similar, and they present very similarly. I thought I was getting weaker on my right side, so they did a battery of tests, and what they figured out is I wasn't getting weaker on my right side, I was getting slower. So because the dopamine isn't acting, and you need dopamine to initiate any action, and so because my timing's off, they're like, "Oh, that's not MS, that's Parkinson's." Mm. If I was weaker, it would be MS.
And about some of the misconceptions that people have, I mean, after you were diagnosed, after you started talking about it, did you find that we're not as hip as we should be about Parkinson's?
Well, I wasn't as hip as I should be about Parkinson's. I didn't even know is it going to kill me? And the answer is no, but I'm going to die with it.
Uh-huh.
And it may lead to other things that happen in my body, other systems that shut down because of the Parkinson's, but the Parkinson's itself won't kill me. So it's a long suffering, degenerative, neurological disease. And then there's probably over 40 non-motor symptoms associated with it.
Uh-huh.
So like right now I have neuropathy in my feet. So my left toes feel like they're on fire right now. And that's been going on for a couple of months. And that has to do with they're still speculating, but the lack of vitamin B in my system. And the vitamin B is blocked by the drugs I take to keep the Parkinson's symptoms at bay, and to replace my dopamine. And so now we've got to figure out, okay, well, how do we get those levels back up? So it's a constant, it's either the disease or the drugs that you're taking to deal with the disease. So like Michael J. Fox, when you see him, you think of those jerky movements where he's moving like that. That's not Parkinson's. That's called dyskinesia, which is a reaction to taking the dopamine replacement drugs for so long.
What is it like for you when you find out what you have? It doesn't give you a due date, if you will. You just said you will die with it, but you obviously don't know when. I mean, it could be 30, 40 years even, right?
That's the scariest part for me.
Yeah.
And the thing that bums me out the most, you don't know what's next, and you don't know how fast your deterioration is going to be. So for me, making the most of every day is really important, and try to, whenever my son wants to play, to make the effort to do it, even if I'm not feeling up to it. But there's some days you just can't answer the bell. And you don't know from day to day if you have a new ache or a new pain or a new symptom. Is that a today symptom, or is that going to be a symptom that I have to deal with from here on out? And you just never know. If you have a bad day, it's hard not to think that this is the beginning. This is where I fall off.
You mentioned Michael J. Fox, another person that came to the fore in terms of our consciousness, in terms of someone having Parkinson's, is Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we all noticed about him as he lived with this condition was that his voice was something that left him, and as someone who works in radio, who has a love of radio, as you do, this is your life. How do you contend with that?
Well, it's one of the symptoms that came on. I could not complete a radio shift. I was doing updates in Seattle, and I was doing a 4 or 5 hour update shift, and about 3 hours in, my voice was like this, and I didn't know why. And I was auditioning for other radio gigs, a morning drive position as a host, and like I'd get an hour into the show, and my voice was like, what is, I thought maybe allergies, yeah. I didn't know what was going on. And so I know that now, looking back, that that was part of that fatigue that I was, you know, it's a symptom of Parkinson's. My voice is thinner today than it was 3 years ago, than it was 6 years ago, than it was 9 years ago when I was doing network updates for Fox or, you know, when I was at ESPN. It's the one thing that I do best is tell stories with my voice and to use my voice, and it's how I've built my career. It's how I'm known, and so to lose that is, it's about the worst thing I can think of.
Yeah, and it's something that you obviously think about every day.
Sure.
What advice have you got for people who are going through something similar like you? I mean, that's probably the only way that one can cope, I suppose, is to talk about it, as you have on this podcast and your various appearances elsewhere, sharing your story. I mean, that's obviously key to your life now, right?
Yeah, I think talking about it's really important, whether it's a one-on-one with a therapist or with my wife or with my son or my mom or my brothers and sisters or through the podcast, or I go to support groups. I go to nursing homes and, you know, that have 13 people there. And I last weekend I was in Toronto at a fundraiser that had 500 people there, and mm-hmm. I spoke to them, you know, so while I can still tell my story, I'm going to, like, yeah, wherever I can, as often as I can. That's part of the podcast. It's the legacy that will have, that my story can continue to live on, even if I do ultimately lose my voice or it gets so soft that people can't hear me.
Sure. Was there any point, Larry, as you were diagnosed, that you thought, I don't want to talk about this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I kind of, you know, I didn't deal with it for 8 years, so why do I need to deal with it now?
Sure.
But, you know, the as soon as you stop paying attention to the Parkinson's makes itself aware. You know, it pulls your attention to it. I wish I didn't have to deal with it, but it's kind of like a roommate that's never going away.
Mm-hmm. And it's a roommate that also affects family members and the sort.
Just like any roommate. Yeah. You know, if you're living with somebody in your house, and it's your wife and your kid and somebody else, that somebody else is going to get in that dynamic.
Yeah, getting them to talk about it, your brothers, your family, your mom even.
Yeah.
Was that something that came naturally to them?
No. But they knew it was important to me, so they were willing to do it. I don't think they knew what to expect. We actually, early on, last summer, before the podcast launch, I called each one of them individually, and we had probably the most intimate conversations we've ever had one-on-one as siblings. And I spent about an hour with each of them on the phone recording that, and we had that a couple of episodes. And then earlier this year, we all met in Florida, and mm-hmm. we recorded around a big kitchen table, which was really, really cool. It was the first time they'd seen me since my diagnosis, and of course, their imaginations kind of go, because they don't see me every day. They're thinking I'm Michael J. Fox, and I'm not to that stage yet. You know, I'm very, you know, I do have walking sticks, and sometimes I need them, and sometimes I don't. My gait is probably my biggest issue. I do have a tremor, but it's pretty managed by dopamine, or by the what they call levodopa carbidopa, which is the medication. I deal with a lot of other issues too, but most of them aren't visible, and so I think they were relieved.
Yeah. What because I listened to the podcast and you know, I've learned so much about you. You know, I knew of you before even we met, but you must have learned something about yourself that you didn't know before all of this, and I'm wondering what that is. I mean, is there something that you would want to tell younger Larry even about how to you know, so something that would have been helpful maybe growing up or
I think you're oftentimes not aware of what you're capable of doing until you're challenged. So, you know, being there to meet the challenge of dealing with this disease, and not only dealing with it and living with it, but becoming an advocate for it, I think what I've learned is that I've probably been preparing my whole life for this moment. So I'm not sure what I would tell young Larry to do other than probably get out there and exercise more, because I exercise and I were frenemies for my whole life. And it was almost like a cruel joke that they said that was the only thing that they could really recommend that would help. But I've committed to exercise. I'm not exercising nearly enough as my doctors would like, but I do have regular classes I go to, and I'm committed to those. And, you know, Chorus has been great in allowing me to, you know, when I need to go to a support group or go to an exercise class or do what I need to do and work around my Parkinson's. And they've been very accommodating that way, which is just terrific.
The aspect of faith is something that I'm curious about, and whether one is has any subscription to religion or the spiritual even, that doesn't matter. But I mean, once diagnosed, once you go through all of this, you're going through all of this, I should say. Is your faith in people, is that tested, say?
My faith in people is probably, I probably have more faith in people today than I've ever had. I depend on a lot of people. You know, before it was just me and my family, and now I've got this team of people that are concerned about my well-being, from my general practitioner to my neurologist to my massage therapist to my physiotherapist to my... You know, like my pharmacist. I see my pharmacist now, like more often than I see anybody.
Yeah.
And so there's this team of people around me that, you know, they don't have to care about me, but they do.
Yeah.
And I, you know, from a faith perspective, we did an episode at the very end of the first season of When Life Gives You Parkinson's, I wanted to talk to spiritual leaders,
right. Like,
how do you deal with this? And I talked to some other people with Parkinson's. Some were religious and some were spiritual. And I'm probably more spiritual than religious. But what I found, the common denominator, whether you're religious or spiritual, whether you're a patient or a doctor or a researcher, the common denominator for all of us was hope.
Mm.
We all have hope. We're all driven by hope. I hope today is the worst it is. And that tomorrow gets better. And I hope the exercise works, and I hope the drugs come around, and I hope the researchers find what they're looking for, and the researchers hope they can cure me. And like, we're all dealing in this hope. And it's not false hope. Somebody said, well, do you feel like it's false hope because there's no cure? I'm like, but there's no such thing as false hope. Hope is hope.
Like, right.
It can't be false. It's just hope. It's just that feeling of it's possible.
Yeah.
So making... No, I probably won't be cured, but I have to have hope that my life's still going to be great.
Hope for a lot of people, though, is hard. And you just think of, say, you know, thinking of politics even or what's going on with our political leaders.
Oh, do I have to think about that?
Sure. But, I mean, you know, that's what a lot of people are talking about. So one wonders, how do you cultivate hope? I mean, is that easy for you?
It comes from a belief in believing in people. You know, having faith in the people around you, to trusting, you know, you got to look around. Who do you trust? And if the answer is nobody, then you need to find new friends. but you surround yourself with people you trust, and you just believe in humanity. And you know, sometimes we got to learn hard lessons to get back on track, and that may be what's going on right now.
We'll talk more about the podcast in just a sec, but I wanted to talk about radio because we've touched on that.
Sure.
That really was, it is for you, and I would assume was growing up a love of radio. That was very important to you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was important to my dad. My dad really, he had 13 radios throughout our house growing up. He always had one on, and he had a police scanner on in a couple of rooms because he was a journalist and a reporter. And so even after he was no longer that, he was constantly monitoring the police scanner. And, you know, so as a young 16-year-old driver, you'd come home with your tail between your legs because you knew he heard you get pulled over by the cops on your way home. So he would sit on the front porch every day of the summer and listen to Cincinnati Reds baseball.
Yeah.
Marty Brenneman and Joe Nuxall, the old left-hander, rallying third and heading for home. And his love of listening to the radio transcended to me. I later thought about it. I thought maybe I got into radio so he would actually hear me talk.
Yeah.
Because once it came through the speakers, then maybe he'd pay attention. But he just loved the medium. I listened to 610 WTVN in Columbus, and we had Bob Connors in the morning and John Corby. And then my first job in radio was producing at 610 WTVN and working with those guys. And it was just like a dream come true.
Yeah. And, thanks to the internet now, we've had that around for 15, 20 years, you're able to listen to other radio stations, you know, around the world even. And, I grew up listening to NW, obviously. But the chance, you know, as the internet came about to listen to, say, you know, WFAN in New York or Winds or, it just made... just all those things that you think about radio and this medium that one grows up with and that loves, I mean, all the more better, right? I mean, you just feel a connection to it.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, it reminds me, the internet's kind of like the old 50,000 clear watt radio stations when I was growing up.
Right.
Sunday night, about, I wouldn't be asleep yet, and I'd sneak on my AM radio, and I could pull in stations from St. Louis and Detroit, and I'm like, oh, this is amazing. Like, Chicago. I'm in Columbus. How am I getting Chicago? You know?
Yeah.
And so that for me is like, or like old Wolfman Jack. He was down in Tijuana, Mexico, but he had jacked up the, it was going to Ohio. Like, I could get Wolfman Jack. That was crazy.
Yeah. Who was Wolfman? Was he someone that you say admired or wanted to emulate perhaps?
Well, sure. I'm sure I emulated him a lot as a kid, you know. But probably, we probably pretended to be the Cincinnati Reds announcers more than anything, just because that's what we heard most often. But, you know, it's on WLW and on WTVN, they had the afternoon shows had characters.
Mm.
So like commentators that were, you know, Earl Pitts America, you know, and so that really rubbed off on me. So when I was doing college radio, I would do a lot of like character voices and stuff. And that was always fun for me. And even when, so I did news first and then, when I arrived in Philadelphia, they'd hired me to be a young morning show reporter for the news department that they were launching on WWDB, which was an FM news talk in Philadelphia to go against KYW. And we got there to do rehearsals. And we had this 13-person news team, which was fantastic. I mean, they just invested in it. It was 1999. And it was a really exciting time. I'd moved from Dayton to Philadelphia. And I got there, and they hadn't hired anybody to do sports. Well, this is Philadelphia. You can't just not do sports.
Sure,
So they go, does anybody know anything about sports? I'm like, hey, I do. I'd never broadcast. I mean, I'd done some play-by-play in college and whatnot, but I've never formally been a sports guy. And they go, you're the sports director.
Yeah.
So we're changing your assignment. So I'd get in at like 2 in the morning to write all my sports and pull all the highlights. And then I'd also write the morning news for Gil Gross and Pat Farnak. And so I was like one of the news writers in the morning instead of the morning reporter. And my sports was a character.
Yeah.
It was Smokey on sports. Yada hoota! You know, and we just this dynamic. And I think that trickled down from listening to characters on the radio when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And it broke through. I mean, I was the fan. Like, hey, if the Eagles won, yeah, all right. If they lost, they suck.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so I became like the Philly fan. And I won awards right away, and then I got called out to L.A. When I was in L.A., I worked at AM 1150, which was Extra Sports. They had the Lakers rights, and so I was there for Kobe and Shaq, and then I helped launch Fox Sports Radio in the year 2000.
Yeah.
So it was a really quick, like, I went from news, and then suddenly I skyrocketed in sports, and it was great.
Yeah. Well, what was it like for you? Was that Mike and Mike at Fox?
It was ESPN. So after I was with Fox, I moved back home to Columbus, Ohio, because my dad was really ill. He was he was going to die. He had a disease called myelofibrosis, and we knew his time was limited. And I just told Fox, I'm like, listen, I got to quit. I got to go home and be with my dad.
Right.
They wouldn't let me quit. They put a studio in my basement. I did national updates from my basement in Columbus, Ohio for Fox for about a year. And then a program director position opened up in Columbus, and I took that. And that's where I was when he passed. And then about a year later, ESPN called and said, how'd you like to program the network?
Yeah.
I'm like, I've only been doing this for a year. I don't know what I'm doing. They're like, oh, come up, take a look. And so I became the program director of the ESPN Radio Network in 2004 or 2005, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I oversaw Mike and Mike in the Morning, the Dan Patrick Show, The Herd with Colin Cowherd, and Sports Beat with Eric Casilius. And so those four shows, Monday through Friday, from essentially 5 a.m. to 7 p.m., that's what I oversaw. It was the best programming job ever. I didn't have to deal with sales, and I didn't have to deal with nights and weekends.
Yeah. So you obviously have, you know firsthand what it's like to, say, manage people, as a program director does.
Yeah, I would say coach people.
Sure.
I learned early on that
talent, a great way to look at
talent,
it, isn't it?
Can't be managed. Yeah. and they shouldn't be. They all bring their own idiosyncrasies, and my job as a programmer, as a coach, is to put them in a position to win. I want to leverage their strengths and try to protect them from kind of the everyday BS flying around the radio station. Everybody wants a piece of these people. And my job is to make sure that the only people that get access to them are worthwhile, because they're talented, and they need to focus on what we want them to do, which is to perform on the air. So if they need stuff, they should let me know. If things are in their way, let me remove those obstacles. That's my job. It took me a while to get to the point where I didn't feel like I needed to micromanage and realize, oh, they're really good at what they do. I just need to give them the space and the tools to win.
Like everybody else, we're reading excerpts of Howard Stern's new memoir.
Right.
I was an Imus fan, but I'm still interested in what Stern has to say. You know, radio seems to me, and I'm sure this is like any other medium, full of ego, but we have a greater connection to radio because it's a lot more accessible, I think, than, say, TV. What's that like to manage egos as you have? You've talked about being on air, say, and you know, at a national level. Here at NW, I mean, 75 years of NW's history, I mean, it great big personalities over the years.
For sure. You know, and part of my job with Chorus now is to coach talent on radio and TV. So I go to Global BC once a week, and I work with talent over there, both anchors and reporters and some of the talent in some of the other markets. And that's what I was a consultant for about 5 years in between gigs. And so, I really, that became what I became known for as a consultant was talent coaching. So I did a lot of morning show coaching in the U.S. and some other, shows around the world, including with Chorus. And at first it can be intimidating because, you know, the talent comes in and they're like, yeah, I've especially if you're a new PD, I've been through five of you.
Yeah.
NW's a little different. There's not been a whole lot of program directors at NW because my predecessors were here for a really long time and for good reason. They had a lot of success. And so part of what I need to do is come into a situation and just sort of evaluate and get to know people and understand what their strengths are, how I can help them, how I can put them in a position to be better at their jobs. They're where they're at because they're good. So it's not that I need to fix them.
Yeah.
Everything I do is incremental. It's not about, it's just new iterations of things. It's making them think, well, here's how you could, this was great.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought of this? Did you try that? hey, as we're doing this, let me build a promotional campaign around this so we can make this bigger. Mm-hmm. It's the little things. It's being honest. Like when things don't go right, you got to just call them out, and not in a disrespectful way. It's not about, you know, slapping them on the hand. It's about, hey, what can we learn from this? I know you feel this didn't go well. I feel it didn't go well. What could we have done differently? And so it's about having conversations with them. And over the years, I've found different talent react to different kinds of communication. Uh-huh. So you have to find out what makes those people tick. Do they want a glass of wine after their show off-site? Do they want to meet in their office? Do they want to have lunch? Do they want a breakfast? Usually the talent don't want to talk about their show in a critical way in front of their peers.
Right.
So you have to respect that, or in front of their team.
Sure.
So it's finding those opportunities and what works, what motivates them the most.
What was it like for you to come to this town? I mean, first of all, you're an American who came to this town. I mean, that's what a lot of people talked about, say, online. As you came.
I know those onliners.
As you came into managing CKNW, I mean, you know, it's a great heritage legacy station, if you will. Mm-hmm. Coming in from elsewhere, was that much of a leap? Did it take time to say adjust to being there?
There was a few adjustments. I mean, radio is radio is radio, but every market is unique. Mm. So when I programmed. Cairo in Seattle right after they moved to the FM dial with their news talk. And I went in there and people were like, you're not from here. You're not from Seattle. You don't get Seattle. When I went to Columbus, I was like, oh, I'm from here. I get this one. Yeah. But when I came here, it's like, yeah, it's like, what's an American doing running this legacy station? And really what I'm good at is coming in and finding how to leverage brands to like reinvigorate heritage brands in a market. And so it was less about trying to manage the people and more about how do we revitalize this amazing historical brand in this marketplace. And so you begin to, you know, for the first year as a consultant, I worked with the management team on what do we do with the brand? Mm-hmm. And so after that work had been done, I was able to come in and then go, okay, so as a consultant, I met with the staff on a Saturday, the entire staff, and we went through a whole bunch of ways that they can use the brand to their advantage.
Yeah.
And so then when I got here, I was a known entity to the people in the building. And you either liked me or you didn't. I'm sure there was both. Or you trusted me or you didn't. And so my job is to build trust with everybody. And let them know I'm not here to clean house. I'm here to support. So it's a process. Like, you don't just come in and start swinging away. You come in and you observe and you listen and you talk to people and you get to know people and you build relationships. And then over the course of time, you begin to go, okay, well, what if we tried it this way? Or I'd like to do that. Or, you know, what's holding us back from being great? And so you look at all those things, and it's a million little things. It's never one big thing.
Yeah. Well, what's the relationship then that a program director has or should have with their listener?
Well, it's, you know, here, it's interesting. That was one of the challenges that I faced was the listeners in Vancouver to CKNW are the most passionate listeners I've ever encountered in my life. And I don't know if it's a Canadian thing or if it's a Vancouver thing or if it's an NW thing, but our listeners feel they have ownership of the station. And that doesn't happen by accident. And as annoying as it can be sometimes, I also cherish it because I want them to feel like they're owners of the station. I want them to feel like they can reach out and talk to me. And I talk to listeners every day, mm-hmm. and they give me a lot of advice. And I thank them for the advice, but I don't always apply it. But sometimes I do. And sometimes you're just keeping track of what the reactions are. And if I get 10 calls about the same thing over the course of a day, then I go, huh. If I get 100 calls on it, like, oh, okay, now wake up, Larry. Something's going on here.
Yeah.
But if I only get one call on it, it's just somebody, you know, I'm not gonna change the programming for one person.
Sure.
But all of the feedback's really important. So people reach out through Twitter, through the email, they call my voicemail, like. And that's great. Yeah. And some people call a lot, and some people call once, and I talk to anybody.
Yeah, that's what makes this market unique, isn't it? I mean, there is a real reliance for the radio, certain radio and television stations for news, and that has always been the case, whether the numbers are as what they would have been, say, 20 years ago. That's a different argument altogether, but they rely on stations like NW.
Yeah, well, I think there's a reliance of stations in the States, too, but there's never been that connection between the program director and the audience.
Mm.
Like, I was nowhere did, unless you answered the phone live, like if somebody called to complain about a station I was programming in the States, I wasn't going to call them back per se.
Yeah.
The only exception was when the Rush Limbaugh got into the Sandra Fluke incident.
Right.
I was programming in Seattle. I had Cairo and I had the conservative talker KTTH. And we just got inundated with stuff about Rush.
Yeah.
A lot of them were not even from Seattle. But I kept a log, and I communicated with everybody about what we were doing and the steps we were taking for different things. And I learned from that experience that when you do communicate with angry people a month later,
yeah,
they really appreciate the follow-up.
Mm.
So then when we had sort of we made some moves in the morning at Cairo, and it didn't go so well. So about 30 days after a morning show shift, we shifted again.
Yeah.
And it was kind of jolting for people to go to make the change and to make another change. But the people who had complained about the initial change, I kept every one of their emails and their voicemail messages. And when we made the second change, I was able to say, thank you for your feedback. Here's what we've done to course correct. And we were able to save a lot of those listeners.
Yeah.
And so I did find value in that at that time, but up until then, and then at NW, it's amplified because it's an everyday thing. It's not an emergency thing. It's not, you made this horrific move. It's like, it's constantly little things here and there, yeah, that they notice.
Well, what have been some of the things that you've heard about over the last 3-4 years that you've been there?
Everything from, You're not talking about enough local stories, which we try to do. We try to put things in local perspective. We'll talk about national stories of interest or international stories. U.S. politics often is very divisive, and so we try to put it through the filter of living in Canada or Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this weekend, you know, I got a complaint that Drex has a dirty mouth. He's being rude to people. I'm like, yeah, it's Drex.
Yeah.
I get complaints that people, like, they'll even, like, it's funny. There's certain listeners that are listening from a, almost like a programmer's point of view. They're like, this host of another show was on with Linda, and she didn't say what time the other show aired. I'm like, shouldn't they be promoting what time to listen? I'm like, well, I suppose so, but it's probably like number 58 on my list of things to do today. But
yeah,
yeah, I mean, so they're trying to help. You know, obviously, anytime we make changes, so when we added Linda, people love her or hate her.
Uh-huh.
They rarely follow up to say I've been listening some more and she's really good. But yeah, I can tell you that that's what's happening because her numbers are really strong.
Yeah.
If we're too opinionated, people don't like that, and a lot of people have a really hard time discerning between the journalists, the news people, and the talk show hosts.
Yeah.
And just because Linda was a journalist, and just because John was a journalist, and just because Simi was a journalist, doesn't mean that's what their job is today. Their job today is to be a commentator, to be an opinion maker, to chew on stories and have a conversation and have opinion about them. And sometimes people go, well, that's not what NW is about. And it's like, well, that's not maybe what NW was about, although I think Jack Webster would disagree.
Sure.
Rafe, they were pretty outspoken people.
Yeah.
And great at what they do, in that our legacy continues in that vein. And I really encourage strong takes, big opinions. People don't always agree with the position they're taking, and so then they say it should just be neutral.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've noticed in terms of the TV shows, the TV stations that I watch, the radio stations that I listen to, and I try to listen to everything, you know, here, is the amount of, say, media literacy that there should be. And I think the radio stations, the TV stations, the newspapers online, they need to do perhaps a better job at, say, you know, so that the audience knows, you know, that a personality can have an opinion.
Right.
You know, and more often than not, an informed opinion is probably better than, say, a balanced one.
Well, and as we integrate with global news and we have more reporters on, some of our hosts are encouraging the reporters to have opinions, and that's not necessarily what we want from those reporters. And so it's training everybody how to use everybody's skills and making sure that we really define their roles. It's interesting as I think about NW and the way that the listeners to react to what we're doing. I find it fascinating that they are so engaged. If we need something, they're there.
Mm.
We're about to launch a campaign asking people for their stories for the 75th anniversary.
Right.
And I have a feeling we're going to get so inundated, we're not going to be able to know what to do with them all.
Right.
But that's a problem I'm open to having.
Yeah. And I was going to ask, you know, what else you have planned for marking the 75th anniversary? Because it still is, I mean, such an important part to people's lives, people's day. It's something that ought to be marked, you know.
Yeah, so the 75th anniversary is August 15th. That's when we went on the air, although our license wasn't really official till September 1st. I'm not sure how that worked, but we're going to mark it on the 15th. We're going to be in New West at the Anvil Center all day.
Really?
From 5:30 in the morning till 6 at night. We're going to have live shows. We're going to have special guests from the, you know, CKNW's past. There's going to be a historian out there with a speech about CKNW, and we'll have old pictures, and, you know, the Kids Fund will be out there and Global will be out there. It's going to be a big fun. Maybe we'll have some food trucks, and, like, you know, it'll hopefully be a day of celebration. In addition to that, earlier that week on the Monday, the 12th, we're going to do a lunch at the Terminal City Club. With George Garrett and some of the CKNW talent, and a $98 lunch that helps. Yeah. You know, some of that money will go to the Kids Fund and just tell old stories about it. Then if you listen today, we launched a couple of months ago, we started creating a series of different promos on the air that sort of harken back and, you know, celebrate the voices of the past. Because I think that's really important to acknowledge the path that NW has been on and all the people that have helped build it into what it is today. It's, you know, I'm a pimple on the butt of CKNW. Like, the people that did the hard work before me should be honored for this, and hopefully we could do them justice.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk to you about, of course, has been investing quite a bit in terms of podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
Your show, obviously, is something that's come out of that. You mentioned a moment ago that you've done one season. There'll be more, obviously, right?
Yeah. So we did a season from September through the end of March, and then in April we began to preview. I'll call it a bonus season, preview the World Parkinson Congress, which is in Kyoto, Japan, next month in June, that I'll be traveling to and doing some podcasting from there as well. And it's a triennial event which brings researchers together with advocates and patients and caretakers and this community of 3,000-plus people that are involved with Parkinson's get together in one place somewhere in the world every 3 years and spend 4 days, you know, trying to figure out what our future is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a series of 13, I guess, the bonus season. I'll take a break, and then in September we'll be back with season two of When Life Gives You Parkinson's. I've got friends that are going through deep brain stimulation surgery, so I'll sort of the before and after, like before what they're have the conversations with them before and after their surgeries. We're going to feature one of Muhammad Ali's daughters, the guy who won the first season of Amazing Race Canada has Parkinson's.
Right.
He's going to be on the podcast. There's a guy that's in the American Ninja Warrior competition. who has Parkinson's, and so we're going to talk to some more prominent people who have been afflicted with the disease. In addition to continuing to tell my story, and my wife and I each episode have a sort of an intimate conversation at the end of the episode. We actually do sit in our bed and talk into our cell phones, and just record it, and then I edit it together, and then she's always like, but you edit out the good parts. I'm like, well, but it made me look good.
Everybody's a program director, I guess, right? That's what I find so compelling are these conversations that you have with your wife, and you know, I do feel sometimes that I'm intruding on your privacy, because it can get awfully personal, and I think that's what also has made this so compelling, is that there's really nothing that one can't ask you.
No, I'm an open book. I say that to everybody. I'm like, it may be uncomfortable, but I think it's important that we tell the unvarnished truth, because there's people like me that I was searching for a podcast that I could relate to. There was no patient perspective out there. And so I saw a niche in the market, and I said, well, let's go. Let's do this. But with the understanding that I told my wife, and I said, like, listen, Henry, our son's going to have to be a part of this. You're going to have to be a part of this. It's going to be awkward at times, because we're going to be rolling tape at weird times. Yeah. And she's been great and open to it. And we've built a community, really, around the world of people with Parkinson's and their caretakers and researchers now, it's really quite amazing.
That was one of the things that in wanting to have you come in and talk on this show, one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I wanted to ask you this, and I don't have to ask you, because you've just demonstrated in the last, just under an hour that we've talked, is that this medium, podcasting, radio, remain relevant?
Oh, it's never not been relevant to me. I think for some people it feels irrelevant. I think one of the things that has damaged radio, especially talk radio, especially when you look to the United States, is that they've gone to this left-right format. You're either all right or you're all left. The filter is politics 100%. And the one thing that I've been trying to instill in my staff is that humans don't look at things 100% through politics.
Right.
There are stories that you need to look at through a political lens, but most stories you can look at through the lens of a father, as a lens of a Canadian, as a lens of somebody who was homeschooled, as a lens of somebody who, has lost their parent when they were a kid. Like, whatever experiences you've been through, look at the story through those different lenses, and you're going to find new ways to talk about them that are more accessible to people and less divisive. And dividing our audience is not healthy. I want our audiences to come together and have conversations and find solutions to things. But if we try to divide them from the start by the way we approach the story, we'll never be able to get there.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the things, if I can claim any credit for some of the success of CKNW, is that we didn't go down the path of hiring a bunch of conservatives or a bunch of liberals. We said, politics be damned. Well, politics will be part of it. It has to be.
Yeah.
Because it's part of human nature. You believe what you believe, and that gets labeled. But there's so many other ways to look at stories. So many other ways to look at stories. And that's what needs to continue to happen with especially spoken word radio around the world, I truly believe.
Yeah. I could talk all day with you, Larry, and I so appreciate you coming in to do this. It's been a pleasure meeting you, and I can only wish you and your family best wishes as the show continues, this life of yours now that you have Parkinson's, as that continues as well as it could.
Thanks. I really appreciate it.
CuriousCast.ca and Apple Podcasts, of course, is Spotify, all these places that one gets podcasts. That's where you ought to go to get when life gives you Parkinson's. @GiffordTweet is the Twitter handle. Larry Gifford, join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.